You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at WeAreLibertarians.com. You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Find more great shows like this at WeAreLibertarians.com.
All right, let's get back to some boring subjects.
Understand the risk to our country.
Freedom brings people together.
You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Network. Learn more at WeAreLibertarians.com.
Welcome to the program. This is episode 451. We're recording this on August 15th, 2020, and we are going to be talking about Kamala Harris's record. She has been chosen this week to be the running mate of former Vice President Joe Biden, who is seeking the Democratic nomination. We're going to talk about her rise, talk about some of the controversies, conspiracy theories out there about her, and then also her record as prosecutor. So stay tuned. We'll take a look at that right after this.
Warning, this show is for adults, produced by semi-adults. So the language is sometimes strong and offensive.
I don't know what I said.
Welcome to We Are Libertarians, where our goal is to help you sound smarter while talking to your friends. We examine current events from a libertarian perspective while treating modern politics with all of the irreverence it deserves.
There has been lie after lie.
We toss out the screaming heads, put people before political parties, and give context to the news to make you think. Now, here's our host, a 15-year veteran of politics and media, Chris Spangle.
Welcome to the program. Had my mic turned around a la Reinhold, like from several episodes ago.
You don't have to do that. You might have to make a public apology.
Yeah, exactly. Did I make you publicly apologize for that?
I think you did.
Good.
You deserved it.
So. Yeah. Harry is at yoga. We're not quite sure where he's at the moment.
He's very centered, so.
Yes. So this is obviously a new time. Josh wants to know, how long have you been a 15-year veteran of politics and media? Now for 17 years, 18 years almost. I'll be 37 next month, and I wouldn't be lying if I said I realized that yesterday and went, holy shit, I'm 37 years old. I'm an adult now. Like, that's middle-aged, especially if, you know, I keep eating Burger King. So, I've been around for almost 20 years in libertarian circles. It's really bizarre. Obviously, go ahead.
You're just trying to sound tough saying Burger King. We know it's Chick-fil-A you eat all the time.
I get HelloFresh, or I make tacos or grill out, but mostly I just eat Panda Express and Chick-fil-A. So. obviously, this is a new time that we are recording, and we are generally going to begin recording on Saturday mornings. We had a show prep scramble before this show. Hody Johns did a great set of notes. We were going to do Donald Trump's record as president on this episode, but the pick of Kamala, is it Kamala? Kamala? I've heard Kamala, but I thought it was Kamala. That's what I hear, you know, how it's pronounced
been,
most of the time.
I've been hearing it so many different ways now that I've kind of forgotten. I think it was Kamala, but
yeah,
that's how I've heard it most of the time.
Well, no disrespect to the senator from California, that I'm going to say Kamala. And then if somebody wants to correct me in the comments, then please. You know, her pick obviously changed things around. And then we also are half done with some of the Trump notes. So we're going to bring you that next week. But instead of recording, so we started out recording every Thursday night forever, and we did that for years, and then we started doing two episodes a week, Thursday nights with Greg and I, and then Tuesday nights with Harry and I, and then two was too much, so we started doing one on Tuesday nights, and now we're just so old that by the time it's 7 o'clock, we're ready for bed, and Chris is saying Kamala, but there's no E in it. So, but anyways, we are going to start recording Saturday mornings. So check out the feeds, bookmark the Facebook page, get notifications on YouTube. You can watch the show live when we do the show. on our feed. You can participate in the chats. We're on Twitch. We're on Periscope. We're on our Facebook group, my personal Facebook page. So you can watch the show on Saturday mornings, and then it'll come out usually Saturday afternoon from here on out. That is just to give you a fresher product, to give you a fresher set of hosts. You know, it's tough fitting in a weeknight show at 7 p.m. when everybody's life, obviously Harry's life has gotten a lot busier. My life is a lot busier. Reinhold's life is about the same. your life is actually a lot busier. So that's why we are going to have a day change. Minor correction, most of you listen whenever you get to it through the week, so it doesn't really matter to you. But for those who do care, that is the explanation. You know, we should start right out of the gate again, because we have a great show prepared by Hody Johns and I specifically. And, but when we get into it, I often forget to thank our patrons. You guys are the backbone of the show. We are, most podcasts are down 25% because half the country, literally half the country, changed their habits and is no longer getting in a car and going to work for one reason or another. So podcast listening is down 25%. We, in the last 2 to 3 months, are tripling the amount of downloads. So there's a lot of new people listening to We Are Libertarians. But with that comes brand new costs and bandwidth costs. And I am actually in the process this weekend of moving us over to a new host that will allow some advertising. And for those of you who don't like advertising, can join our Patreon, and you will get an ad-free show, and you will also get the full feed. We have capped the feed. You can no longer go back and get the complete catalog of We Are Libertarians for a myriad of reasons, but mainly because most of the things I said pre-2018 were really embarrassing, and I have grown as a person, and I decided to cut about 400 audio pieces out of the feed for the public, and you can really only hear from 2018 on, because I think that's some of our better work. And when I refer to a show and I want you to hear about immigration, anything pre-2018, you know, me specifically, I was very light. So that is why we're capping that and only making that available to our patrons. And you'll see that transition over. If you have anything wonky with the feed over the next week or so, let me know. But that comes with a cost. It is pretty much a doubling of our monthly hosting costs, but we can afford it thanks to our patrons, and specifically our $100 a month patrons. And we thank them so much. They are Reinhold, Matthew Durbin, the lovely, wonderful Christy Avery, who is now our Patreon coordinator, who will be reaching out to many of you, Jeff Bennett, Jason Doolittle, Ed Brehab, Craig DaCosta, Brad Tracy, and Anthony Meyer, who is very handsome. So we thank you patrons for helping us continue our growth. So we're taking another step. This is a big milestone for me. I signed my first contract for 12 months. I signed my first contract ever for anything for We Are Libertarians yesterday, and it was such a weird feeling. It's like when I heard the intro for the first time, I was like, wow, this is turning into a real radio show. When I signed my first contract, I was like, maybe this is turning into a real business. It's very odd, Reinhold.
Right, but did you make sure to sign it as a business, a DBA, a corporation of some sort? Protect yourself.
I, as a borderline anarchist who believes in a night watchman state, I will not form a corporation that is government propaganda. No, I it is not a DBA. Also, you might mute your phone, please.
I will do that.
All right. So we want to jump right into it and start talking about Kamala Harris. We do have this question here. Will you keep the older episodes like Rachel's Story and the others like it in the normal feed? Yes, the cost episodes will be in there. A lot of that stuff. But if there's something that is missing and you want to share it with your friends, let me know. It will be available on the website, so you can go back and listen to older shows on the website. It just won't be available in the RSS feed, like I said, for a myriad of reasons, partly just the content, partly because of cost, partly because it's you know, James' niece, Maya. So, and what they may have said in this environment of cancel culture.
Is the fight still going to be available?
It isn't. No, you cannot hear Chris Galt in episode 39 try to punch Creighton Harrington unless you're a Patreon member now. They literally took a swing. We had a fist fight after an episode in the 30s back in 2013. So this show used to be so nuts.
And what about the moving out episode?
That is behind the paywall too now. Yep.
Those are some good episodes you want to get in that paywall for if you can.
Yeah, the episode. So I got divorced in February of 2014, and the catalyst for the divorce was a recording of We Are Libertarians. Not just that specifically, but like there are a lot of reasons why we didn't work out. But in that episode, we were doing, it was Greg, Gina, and I were talking about something. I had forgotten to tell her that we were going to record that night. She walked in on a Tuesday night, saw us there, got ticked that I didn't tell her, started packing her stuff, and never came back. And I didn't stop the episode. We had to finish. The show must go on, okay? But you hear in that episode in late February of 2014-ish, you hear me go completely silent through the rest of the episode. Greg and Gina carried it. And then I disappear for like 4 months as my life fell apart. So, yeah, you could probably find that on the YouTube channel, too, as all that stuff's published. That's probably somewhere in the 40s or 50s in terms of when we published it. So this show has brought on several marriages, Jeremiah and Sarah Morrill, the Boss Hog of Liberty. It's brought on several relationships that have not turned into marriage, including the one I'm in now. It's also brought on two divorces, mine and someone else. So, yeah, crazy, crazy show. The years between 2013 and 2017 were a lot of fun, but a lot of crazy stuff in those feeds. So definitely worth going back and checking out the whole catalog. If you're a fan of this show, it is really some wild stuff. So much different than, you know, the kind of show we do now, which is about, you know, trying to educate you on, oh, your uncle is sharing that Kamala Harris slept with her boss. What does that mean? You know, that's much different than, why did this co-host sleep with that co-host? So, all right, let's get on with the program. Let's talk about California Senator Kamala Harris was chosen as Joe Biden's running mate this past week. They are both a presumptive nominee for president and vice president. And we want to give you a look at her record, but we want to start with her bio points and just hit some bio points. Now, we are going to do, because by virtue of time, we're going to do a gloss over of much of this. But if you want to go deeper on any singular point, we have 7 pages of show notes. There isn't a podcast out there, let alone a libertarian podcast, in my opinion, that gives you as much sources of where we find our information. Because in this day and age, when you don't know what to trust and believe, we try to show our work so then you can go back and look for yourself. But if you have more interest in learning about a specific bullet point that we're talking about through this episode, you can always go to WeAreLibertarians.com or in the description of the podcast on your podcast catcher and grab the PDF and check out our show notes. Once again, thanks to Hody John. So Senator Kamala Harris, that's what I'm going with. Kamala Harris, I have trouble with anybody's name in general, so I apologize. Born in 1964 in Oakland, California, she was born to an Indian mother who was a breast cancer scientist, and they immigrated here to go to specifically Berkeley, where they eventually ended up teaching. Her father was a Jamaican and a professor of economics at Berkeley, obviously very intelligent parents. And they grew up, now, some of the stuff that we're going to talk about, I'm only talking about because other people are talking about it. In my general opinion, Reinhold, if you're talking about her sexual history or her race, I think it's cretinous. I think it's generally gross, and I think it's counterproductive for convincing people to your side. What say you?
I agree completely, and I think it's usually a sign of, A, they don't have anything else to talk about, which isn't true in this case. or that's just where their mind is. That's the type of things that are at the front of their minds.
Yeah.
You know, do you hear that sort of thing? So we talk about, you know, we hear people talking about Kamala and her boss, but how much do we talk about, you know, Trump and all of the stuff that he's gone through and all the sexual exploits, blah, 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 blah. And the same people who are going to attack her on this are going to defend him on all of his activities. And it's almost like it's because she's a woman trying to be in the position of power.
I'm sure there's an element of that. And I just think that it's also an element of the right, specifically the former Tea Party, which I learned this week still exists here in Indiana somehow. They talk apparently a lot about QAnon, according to a friend. But there is, it goes back to the book Richard Hofstadter's Paranoid Style in American Politics. Jesse Walker wrote a book on conspiracy theories that kind of talks a lot about this mindset. You know, every Democrat that runs for national office isn't a citizen. John McCain wasn't a citizen. You know, Obama wasn't a quote unquote real African American. You know, as if they're qualified, lily white Republicans in Tea Parties are qualified to make that determination. And they're doing it. They're doing a lot of they're breaking out some of the greatest hits of the birther movement on Senator Harris. So that's why we want to address it, because other people are talking about it. And when they talk about it, we want you to understand what they're saying and why. And here's the facts. But I generally think there's plenty in her record, and it's the same with Joe Biden and the sniffing stuff. Like, there's plenty. I'll share the memes because they're funny, but there's plenty in his record that is grotesque, as evidenced by a previous episode, that you can make the case on. You know, it's like you can make the case for government shutdowns not being appropriate without being a total conspiracy nut on COVID being a hoax. It's just it all kind of falls into that paranoid style in American politics. So, you know, for what it's worth, she did grow up in a black part of Oakland in the 60s and 70s. She was born in 64. She grew up in specifically Berkeley, where she was a participant in busing to a northern part of Berkeley, a more affluent part of town. And in that busing, where she was a part of it, the school went from 95% white to 40% black. And so that is the moment that when people say that she called Biden a racist, she didn't call him a racist. She said that he was palling around with segregationists and supported policies that hurt black people like her in that debate. So you can find out.
And
go ahead.
And that's a similar thing that we have with a lot of somewhat tangential groups to the alt-right that we have in different movements, where they may not be racists, but they tend to spend time defending or working with racists an awful lot.
Yeah. Right. And so she didn't specifically call him a racist, but, you know, the implication was clear. She said she stood with the women, you know, and then now she's changed her mind. So she meant it or she didn't. So while she also grew up going to black Baptist churches and Hindu temples. Now, while her parents were not citizens at her birth, she was born in America, and it makes her a natural born citizen and eligible to be president. The right is going to have so much fun, Reinhold, with the concept of her being a quote-unquote anchor baby. She is eligible to be president because she was born here. And we linked an article from Reason that talked about why the founders felt that if you were born within American territory, you can be president.
Right. And so I've had conversations with some people who are trying to, like, overly document some discussions that were made back in the day when they were writing the Constitution and how they really meant this and they really meant that. But the preponderance of the history of and the documentation of what that stuff means, the common law, the the adjudication of it is that if you're born here, you're a natural born citizen. So it comes down to the problem that natural born citizen is used in the Constitution, but it is not defined in the Constitution. So then right. people have to define what that means. And there are people now trying to make the case that in order to be a natural born citizen, you have to be born in the United States and both of your parents have to be citizens, right, at the time of your birth, which eliminates like six presidents that we've had.
It's never been the standard. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the history shows that that's not the case, but they're still going to try and make the case. And it's similar to the right trying to make the argument on the case of citizenship, you know, the anchor baby stuff and things like that, where we have an amendment that was discussed and talked about, and they knew exactly what they were voting for when they voted for that.
Right.
They knew they were voting for a case of when they passed it, that if you were born here, you were a citizen, you know, straight out. There was no equivocation of it. The only equivocation was something to do with the Indian tribes, because technically they had different, they were sovereign, countries within our country. So there were some going back and forth on that technicality of it, but for everybody else, that was the case. If you were born here, you were a U.S. citizen. So, re-adjudicate this whole mess, for their own purposes, for own political purposes. So, I mean, that's what they do. So,
now
we just keep having to have this argument over and over and over again, and it gets tiresome.
It's like local politics here in Indiana. We constantly have the residency fight, like it's, you know, Evan Bayh or Dick Lugar or whomever, and it's always, you know, from the right, and it's like it never has worked, it never will work. It just makes you look like you're lazy. It's sort of libertarians sort of do the thing with debates where it's like they're scared to debate me. No, they're not. They're not even thinking about you in any way, shape, or form. They don't want you involved because they don't think about you and they don't think you're relevant. Like, they're not scared of you.
They don't want you to take the air out of the conversation that they're trying to have, too. So the debates are for the two people who actually can win so that they can get their message out. And if a third person's up there taking time away who has no chance to win, that's why they don't want them up there. It's not right. because they're worried about, oh, they're going to make me look bad. No, they don't think that, so...
So some in the MAGA crowd are highlighting an ancestor that owned slaves. This is true. An Irish-born grandfather in Jamaica. Her great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was a slave owner, and it is likely that her great-great-great-great-great-grandmother was one of those slaves and was raped, as often happened, and that her ancestors, her great-great-great grandfather, I think, was grandfather and mother was a product of slave rape. So continue pushing that line. There's an ugly fact.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out the relevance, but
it does.
They can keep talking about it all they want, because I think that only kind of adds to the arguments that a lot of people on the left have been trying to make for centuries. So
it's it's the hypocrisy of it. It's whatever. Yeah. So Harris attended Howard University in D.C. and graduated in poli-sci and econ, and she went on to the University of California for her law degree and was admitted to the California bar in 1990. Now, this is when her early career begins, and she began her career as a prosecutor as a deputy district attorney in Alameda County. We're talking about Senator Kamala Harris, who is now the running mate of Vice President Joe Biden. And in 1994, this is the Willie Brown stuff. You may see your Facebook friends basically say, "Oh, she slept her way to the top." So here's what they're talking about. These are just the facts according to everybody involved. 1994, California Assembly Speaker Willie Brown appointed Harris to the State Unemployment Insurance Appeals Board, and later the California Medical Assistance Commission. Harris took a leave of absence from her prosecutor job in Alameda County to serve in those positions. Willie Brown was a kingmaker. As we said, he was the head of the California Assembly at the time. And she was 30, he was in his mid-60s, and he was married. And it was obviously an open secret that they were dating. Now, in those positions, on those two patronage positions that she got, she made over $400,000 in those positions. In one case, I believe it was the Unemployment Insurance Appeals Board, she was paid like $999,000, which in today's money is $150,000, and she only came to two meetings. Now, their relationship ended, and he returned to his wife, and they remained friendly. He convinced L.A. Mayor Villaraigosa to stay out of the Senate race when she ran, for instance. And by all accounts, you know, this was a consensual relationship. He was having marital issues. He has confirmed that this relationship took place. You know, it for a person who runs on fighting corruption, it obviously looks bad. But not one person who criticizes that relationship. It's an easy thing to criticize, and it's been a constant criticism in her career. But who knows the nature of that relationship? They dated for months, so I'm sure that it was not just a relationship of convenience. There was probably feelings there. I mean, I think it's kind of ugly just to dismiss it as what it is, but it obviously doesn't look great if you're, you know, trying to run as an anti-corruption candidate. What do you think, Reinhold?
Well, the question is, was she trying to run as an anti-corruption candidate while this was going on, or did she maybe learn from that? I mean, there's, how can you judge that sort of thing? You know, it's not like she didn't have things that she was bringing to the table that made her qualified for what position she was getting.
She was already a rising star in a prosecutor's office. You know, she had chops.
And how many jobs were given out for patronage, but that has nothing to do with sex, right? I mean, that has nothing to do with that sort of thing.
Because they're friends.
You're friendly with someone. You know somebody.
Like, let's say you're friends with the president, and he fires everybody at the post office, and he gives you a job. What about that? Yep.
Yeah, I mean, that's that could be considered corruption, right? I mean, if something like that were to ever to happen, not that it would.
I think the question is, what difference does it make now? And the answer is, she went on to a long career in multiple different levels and showed skill, not as you'll see, skill at things that we hate, but, you know, is it relevant at this point in her career? And in my opinion, it's not.
Yeah. And the other thing too, is how many times do you hear about a man who's slept his way to the top? Right.
I'm trying, but it's never happened.
Exactly. It's like, it's kind of like a charge that's only levied against women trying to be in power. Right.
Right.
So it's that old canard where the old boys club tries to do what they can to keep that from happening.
Yeah. So, fun fact, more about her relationship. She dated Montel Williams in 2001. I saw the Daily Mail report that with a picture of the two of them at some red carpet sighting dressed in their full early 2000s fashion. It was hilarious. Now, after this, she worked as a private attorney specializing in youth sexual abuse cases and domestic violence. As a DA, she would go on to take a less punitive approach to sex workers as a result in some cases. She would also go on to co-sponsor a law that would have banned sex offenders from social media, as well as a law that imposed a curfew on them on Halloween. So fighting sex trafficking and sexual abuse became, as you pick through her record, it's schizophrenic. And there is a lot, and this is why some of the things that we've talked about kind of hit in a certain way, is because she seems very phony. And she'll say one thing and do another, but then she'll correct, and then she'll flip. She did this during the presidential campaign. You know, she went really hard on one direction and then got pushback and then went the exact opposite way a week later, you know, trying to reposition herself as someone else. Like she tried to look like a full progressive and then realized Pete had that lane. And so she corrected and went the other way. And it's like, she gets tagged with the ambition, which we'll talk about female ambition in a moment, but she gets tagged with that because she is so often inconsistent. And so she'll say, I'm for sex workers, but then she prosecutes them really aggressively, you know? So it sometimes doesn't make a lot of sense in what she does.
So what I'm hearing is that she's a politician.
She is really, truly a politician in the classic sense of it. You know, she's just, yeah. So I want to play a couple pieces, and this will be in the show notes, but Reason on the 12th, August 12th, put out a video. Kamala Harris, drug warrior, vice cop, draconian prosecutor. It kind of highlights some of this viewpoint that is schizophrenic. So let me pull this up so everybody can see it.
Harris's political rise has been propelled by a years-long, high-profile campaign against alleged sex traffickers. What she's actually done is throw women in jail for having consensual sex while trampling on the rule of law to advance her own political ambitions. Ignoring the pleas of sex workers and human rights advocates for over a decade, she's fought against campaigns to decriminalize consensual adult prostitution in California. As attorney general, she created a statewide program to get truckers to report suspected sex workers to police. These policies didn't stop traffickers, but they did land plenty of sex workers behind bars.
One of the greatest offenders is Backpage.com.
Harris fought to destroy Backpage.com, a classified site that sex workers use to find and screen their clients, even though she publicly admitted that the site's founders, Michael Lacey and James Larkin, were protected from prosecution under federal free speech laws.
But tonight, a groundbreaking arrest.
But a month before Election Day in her Senate race, Harris went ahead and had them arrested anyway, parading them before the cameras on pimping charges, which were then promptly dismissed by a judge. When Harris got to Congress, she kept up her crusade, becoming a big proponent of the 2018 law known as Sesta Fosta.
One cannot cowardly sit behind a computer committing their crime. Quite the contrary.
The result was that many sex workers had no choice but to return to the streets, where soliciting clients is considerably more dangerous.
It's because you don't know who's going to pick you up.
There's more pimps and there's more guys out here.
Meanwhile, Harris declined to intervene in a real underage sex trafficking scandal that involved dozens of police and other local authorities in the Bay Area.
Okay, so, I mean, it's, you know, again, it's... say one thing, do another. A lot like Joe Biden's record. They're really made for each other. They really are both, you know, saying that their record says one thing, and now they say they're against what they did forever. So
right. And looking at the current race, so if we look at the Democrats and Republicans in the presidential race, all four of them are exactly like that.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, there's the old joke about Trump where there's always a tweet where he completely contradicts himself from years earlier from what he's saying now. And, you know, and we all know Pence very well. But
or just, yeah, Biden, just like just for an
whatever
example,
it takes to get the power, whatever it takes to get elected, whatever it needs to do. Like when you said she was trying to be the progressive, she saw that the wind was blowing to where the centrist was going to probably win the nomination. So she tried to correct to go back into being a centrist side on the Democrats. So, you know, whatever it takes to win.
Exactly
is
right.
What it is.
Yeah.
And when we were talking about the things that she didn't do, or she didn't go after the scandal and the cops with that. Doesn't she also turn a blind eye to the church molestation issues that were going on at the time?
I have not heard that.
Okay.
So, I mean,
I'd heard that and I need to research it.
It's one of those things that you hear on a podcast and then you're like, I wonder if that's true.
I read it, but it was like, I need to read to make sure that it's founded in a little bit more than just where I read it at, I imagine. So
now let's go on to her prosecutorial record. Let's go on to Kamala Harris's prosecutorial record. She was in 2003, she unseated an incumbent DA, Ternice Hallian, in an upset by building a broad coalition of supporters ranging from low-income minority voters to Bay Area elites. She was in tune and well-networked with both of those. So she was going to cocktail parties with the elites in the Silicon Valley area to win this Alameda County prosecutorial seat. And she knew everybody, knew everything about them. It reminded me about reading about Barack Obama in like Chicago politics early on, going to things, and he knew every person in the room, why they were important. He was well prepped, and you know, knew who to schmooze. But she also maintained a lot of connections in low income areas and minority communities, and was able to speak to both. And that is, on the Democratic side specifically, a skill that helps a politician rise quickly. You know, are they able to speak the language of the, because make no mistake about it, the Democrats, for whatever, you know, Republicans or corporatists and big money politicians, like, the reality is, I watched a great show on Apple TV about, it's called Morning Show, and it's about the Me Too movement. Highly recommend it. Great show. But, you know, it's the New York City cocktail parties on the Upper West Side and the fabulous, they're all talking Democratic politics. You know, you have to court those voters as well as going to lower income areas and courting to those voters. And people who have the ability to do both tend to rise fairly quickly, as she did.
And that was a knock against Pete Buttigieg, too, was that he was courting the high end part of the party, but he was failing to connect with the regular guys,
right?
The regular man.
So this is really when she began to be tagged with the ambition, because the way that she ran the race essentially was, you know, she didn't do a lot different as the prosecutor, but the way that she jabbed elbows in that race, you know, it was very similar to the way that she did it through the presidential campaign. I want to talk about ambition, because this is a, it seems to me that female ambition gets knocked, but Trump is super ambitious. Joe Biden has been ambitious his whole career. Pete Buttigieg is ambitious. Like, where does Pete Buttigieg get off being a failing mayor of South Bend of Indiana? We live in Indiana. We know it's rough up there. And he's going to run from the mayor of the fourth largest town in Indiana to be president. Like, that's, he's super ambitious. Like, everybody in Indiana has known this guy has significant ambitions. And, but it only seems to be a tag on females in politics. But the founders really cared. They knew that people were ambitious. Like, it's the whole basic premise of economics. Scarcity is at the foundation of economics. You never feel that you have enough. People never feel that they have enough. They see, you know, you have a Ford F-150 while your neighbor has a Maserati. You always look at what you don't have. And in politics, people always have an ambition to rise in the ranks and gain power. And the American system, that ambition was pitted against each other. The two-party system pits it. That's why I'm critical of Republicans on things like the post office or Trump's executive order trying to take spending power when only the House has the ability to do that. It's the Republicans that are to keep that ambition to grow power in check, because we know the Democrats are going to oppose whatever Donald Trump does. That everybody knows that. It's not relevant. Like, it's their criticism doesn't matter. It's the criticism from Republicans to a Republican president that matters. And so ambition is just a part of politics. It will always be a part of whatever system of human organization exists. If you have a Rotary Club in your small town, there's always somebody who wants to be the leader, and there's ambition there. And so the American system was really built with that in mind. So I don't fault people for having ambition. I have ambition. I have big goals and big dreams for We Are Libertarians and what I want it to be. That's just part of life, right? Everybody has an ambition to finish college or finish whatever. What makes it grotesque is that she wants to control other people and be in charge of controlling others.
Right. I think the other thing too is that people understand that everybody has ambition, and that's actually a good quality that people find. You know, a lot of times when marriages break apart, it's, you know, because the one person says the other person wasn't trying to do better or trying to improve themselves or trying to didn't have any ambition, right? The problem comes in when you're willing to violate certain ethical mores and your own thought processes and what you believe in order to attain that ambition, right? To get that power, to get that control, to get the next rung of the ladder. If you're willing to step on the people to get there, if you're willing to bend the rules or break them completely, that's when it becomes a negative attack on someone.
Yeah, for sure. While Kamala Harris touted that she was tough on crime, she was often criticized by local law enforcement for, and this plays into the ambition role, for only pursuing cases that she knew she could win to pad her record. She didn't want to have a loss on her record that could be used against her in future runs. And the local law enforcement, she came in being supported by the police, but by the end of her run as prosecutor, she was not well-liked by the police afterwards, because when she would be called out for not taking on tough cases, she would blame sloppy police work. So she ended up for being a cop, she ended up not being well-liked by a fellow cop. So now her felony conviction rate was far lower than her counterparts, but higher than her predecessor in specific areas like murder rates. Now, as libertarians, we're not necessarily apt to look at that as a positive. Oh, you're really effective at prosecuting felonies. Most of those were victimless crimes, so we're not down with that. Her conviction rate, she increased the conviction rate, like I said, from her predecessor, from 52% to 67%, and that was the highest in a decade, and it was an 85% conviction rate among homicides. Drug crime convictions went from 56% to 74%, and this is especially where the libertarian critique starts to come in. You know, what was the fact about 1,500 marijuana users? She aggressively pursued anybody that had marijuana in her jurisdiction.
Yeah, she really ramped up the prosecution on marijuana convictions, and then when asked about whether she had ever smoked marijuana, she laughed.
Right. She was prosecuting and putting people in jail and said that, she was a huge drug warrior as a prosecutor because it was popular at that time. Much like Joe Biden, when it was popular, she was for it. And then when it was unpopular, she was against it. And now, oh, mea culpa, my bad. And of course, everybody just, what I love about the progressive left is that the Bernie bros are growing a movement that might hold some of these politicians, these authoritarian Democratic politicians to account, and saying, no, it's not popular that you put these people in jail. You should actually apologize and have real contrition for what you've accomplished. As we saw with Joe Biden's record, the man put millions of people in jail based on the various things that he championed, and Kamala Harris played into that.
And her thing too is that she's trying to get high conviction rates, right?
Right.
So murder and rape and things like that are harder to convict on than drug crimes. So you go after the drug crimes. And where are the drug crimes located at? Based off the statistics, because the drug war was started and it's a specific reason.
Yeah.
Those statistics show that there's a certain community that has more drug crime in it. So you go and you extra police that community, which inflates the statistics to kind of keep that perpetual motion going. And then it just becomes easy to pull people in and get a conviction rate. So you can get your conviction rate really high on those types of crimes so that you don't have to focus so much on the other crimes that are really the ones that you should be focusing on. The real victim crimes that they're just harder to convict on.
Yeah. I view, for instance, the grassroots Black Lives Matter overall message of criminal justice reform. I view that as, an ally to what libertarians have been championing for so long, you know, ending mandatory minimums, reducing victimless crimes, reducing felonies for things where people, you know, these are core libertarian principles, you know, when which always blows my mind that libertarians argue against the concept of systemic racism.
What's the Do you remember the number of the episode we did with John Odermatt, where we talked a lot about that?
Yeah, I mean, that is a lot
of things we want to change, right? So
yeah,
that's the message that we that libertarians have been saying for decades, that stop with the victimless crimes. Let's focus on a police power, in if you're going to have that, you know, there's calls for, you know, privatizing police and things like that, but you really want your police department to be focused on the things that are really hurting other people, the crimes that are really hurting other people, and not, you know,
yeah, victimless
crimes, jaywalking, things like that. It's just silly.
Jaywalking, prostitution, licensing enforcement, you know, the people that are going around. Harry was so right. So Harry sparked my brain on something. He said, you know, all the smoking bans that went into place 10 years ago that libertarians argued against by saying this will build a mechanism that will bring enforcement in other areas. I checked around to some friends, and the Marion County Health Department here in Indianapolis is going in and fining local businesses $1,000 if a single patron isn't wearing a mask, thereby turning business owners into cops. And you're fining businesses like restaurants and bars that are barely making at $1,000 or $5,000 for five instances on businesses that are struggling right now. It's incomprehensible. A lot of those businesses are supporting people in the lower income brackets of various races, you know? And so when we get tough on crime or we get tough on drugs, as Biden and Harris have done, they're disproportionately affecting lower income workers while turning around and saying that's who they support. It's complete and total hypocrisy. If you support Black Lives Matter and you look at the record of the two of these people, I don't know how you reconcile that, because you can't. You can't look at the fact that Joe Biden, when you look at Joe Biden's record, as we did in episode 450, when systemic racism is defined in 2020, it is all of the things that Joe Biden championed and Kamala Harris enacted as a prosecutor. She used all of Joe Biden's tools. Like, have they changed? I don't know. You know, I see Kamala Harris helping pass SOSTA and FESTA. You know, I see her saying one thing and doing another on a consistent basis. I see Joe Biden saying fairly blatantly racist things, and he gets a pass because he's a Democrat and he's up against Trump. Like, I don't know how you reconcile that as a Biden voter, or if you care about the Black Lives Matter movement. I can't, which is why I'm not going to vote for them. I'm going to vote for Joe Jorgensen and Spike Cohen, who actually walk the walk and talk the talk on this stuff. So her conviction rates were largely because of plea deals. Of 73 first-degree homicide convictions, she accepted manslaughter, third-degree murder on 32 of them, and second degree for nearly all others, meaning she didn't do her job in prosecuting the actual crime, but pleading down to a lesser crime. So she padded her statistics. And so what a lot of the problem with plea deals a lot of times is that a person will be arrested and the prosecutor will tack on a ton of charges. They'll find the most draconian law that they can, passed in 1904, and tack that on and get you to plea down and say, all right, well, you're facing 900 years unless you plea down to this, and you'll only get 18. And it's a way for a prosecutor to pad their record. It's a way for them to get convictions when they don't really have a case on the actual criminal charge. You know, let's say Reinhold goes out and commits a murder, but they don't have enough evidence, so they get him on tax evasion, you know, or something like that, because it's a lesser charge. So, you know, in general, libertarians believe in prosecuting a person for the crime that they committed. But, you know, if you talk to a prosecutor, they go, we know this person committed the crime. We just don't have the evidence nailed, you know, locked tight, and we want to take a bad person off the street. So, you know, that's their defense. You know, she got someone who committed multiple sexual assaults to plea to battery, for instance. Now, Hody, our researcher, says a prosecutor is supposed to convict the actual crime committed and plea deals are supposed to be reversed for mutual benefit. It is a system that is abused by most prosecutors, to be sure, but nobody abused it more than she did. I highly recommend the book Three Felonies a Day to see how corrupt prosecutors like Harris use this tactic and abuse it to advance their careers and pad their stats. The journey ends in innocent, nonviolent people getting hurt. So, also while she was prosecutor, she opened a special unit that investigated bullying of people in what Hody calls the GSM community, which is the LGBT community, but I just, it's gender and sexual minorities, which has been pushed because there's a fight over LGBTQ, you know, and then you see the alphabet soup. The one article I read is it's like GSM, isn't that like the Game Sports Network or whatever? And so I looked it up and they were like, there's just too many LGBTQs, so let's just go with GSM. Now, as Hody says, one might argue that expansion of hate crimes is a detriment, but the budget requiring special hate crimes investigations was passed by Congress. She simply extended this protection to the community, and crimes targeting these individuals are valid hate crimes if we are forced, as Harris was, to assign special investigations to hate crimes. I don't know that I agree with Hody on that assessment. I think hate crimes can often be subjective, and it just gives another tool of prosecutorial stacking, as it's called. What say you, Reinhold?
Well, hate crimes are very. I've got a long history with discussing.
Well, you've committed so many
hate crimes. It's just because
Reinhold, hate crime expert.
I can see both sides. Huh?
Hate crime expert Reinhold.
Expert on it. No, it's just so I have a problem with it where you can say how can you prosecute somebody or sentence them based off what they were thinking, what was in their head, right? But then we give a lesser sentence because of the same reasons, right? So if you kill somebody, but you were killing somebody because you were in a mental state that made it harder for you to make rational decisions, right? You were angry, they had hurt your wife or something, and so there's extenuating circumstances that then get applied to the sentencing of the crime that gets taken into effect, right? So what's the difference between that and a hate crime where you say, okay, what the person was thinking or whatever should change the sentencing of that person? Now, I don't believe that it should change. There should be an actual statute that's different than a regular crime. Like if you commit a crime, you commit a crime. If you commit murder, commit theft, you commit something like that, you've committed that crime. But where the hate crime statute should come into play, if they're going to be used, is in determining what the sentencing of that crime should be. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So as a libertarian, you know, I think that as long as we're focusing on crimes that are not victimless crimes, crimes that have harmed somebody else, and we're taking the state of the mind of the person into consideration on the sentencing side of things, then that's when you get into whether that's acceptable or not. I think there's room on either side for that one. But what I always hated was somebody who was innocent because of insanity instead of guilty, though insane, right? So to say that somebody's innocent because they weren't of a mind where they could make a rational decision, I don't like the way that's worded. I think it should be that you were found guilty of the crime, but because you were incapable of making the valid decision at that point, we're going to expunge it or give you a punishment that is related to getting your mental health back in shape, right? But when it comes to hate crimes too, I think that there is a place for it to be used as an additional sentencing tool.
Okay. Now let's talk about her abilities as a prosecutor and basically her ethics. A lot of
or lack thereof.
Yeah. A problem with Senator Kamala Harris, especially during her prosecutorial years, is ethics. And that is what a lot is called into a question, into account for a question. If many of her detractors on the right took the time to read information and facts and statistics, they would look at the ethical problems of her prosecutorial record and not her sexual history, for instance. But the fact is everybody feels like people are not people individually may be stupid, but there's a wisdom of crowds that feels out a person and sort of judges a person's character. And there's a lot about Biden, Hillary Clinton, Kamala Harris that feel phony, like, you know, like Donald Trump, we all know is a bullshitter. You know, we all kind of know what's going on. It's just people they rationalize, can I vote for this person? But she's the type of person that has pushed boundaries in an effort to position herself a certain way. And innocent people got hurt when she was a prosecutor. So, for instance, there are over 1,000 drug-related sentences that were overturned due to her faulty practices. So while her conviction rate was high, her ability to retain those sentences was low due to the false nature of her prosecution. Now, Harris made the first arrest of Backpage CEO. Backpage was, CEO Carl Ferrer. Backpage was a website that you could go, and it basically was connecting sex workers with Johns. And you could screen them out, and, it was an online tool for prostitution, for instance. So he was not convicted on these arrests or charged on them, but eventually pled guilty to another arrest for similar charges that were filed. Backpage was a site that, quote, according to them, unknowingly offered young prostitutes to buyers on top of illegal substance sales. Harris alleges that 99% of these girls were under 18. I have no idea. I've never been to the site. Really one of the first times I've heard of it was doing the research for this show. It seems to me that it strains credulity to say that 99% of the women that were on Backpage were underage, under 18. I mean, I don't know. So she busted them while sex trafficking occurred on the website. And let's be honest, it was a feature of the website. The owners were actually very good about reporting suspicious listings to authorities. So they did cooperate with local law enforcement. And our researcher, Hody, added in a link that you can verify all this stuff. Our show notes are up at wearelibertarians.com or in the podcast description on episode 451. But instead of prosecuting the sex traffickers that the page owners had reported, Harris and her teams went after the same people who were open with authorities. So instead of going after and prosecuting the people that were the Backpage people were reporting, they prosecuted Backpage. They said, free activity between two consenting adults cannot take place. We need to get rid of the thing that is keeping sex workers safer than not. She was instrumental in shutting down the Backpage site and arresting nonviolent offenders and sex workers. And what this did is it forced many of them back onto the street where they were violated and abused by pimps and drug users. I mean, and any number of people. As Hody, our researcher, says, good prosecutors go after pedophiles, rapists, and traffickers. Harris went after website designers that were explicit about calling out pedophiles, rapists, and traffickers. She actually arrested two of them, even after publicly admitting they were innocent of the charges, and a judge was forced to throw out her bogus charges. She also advocated a law that would force truckers to turn in sex workers. So I want to go back to this Reason video that kind of encapsulates this a little bit more and gives you a better view of it. So let's take a look at this. This is from Reason.com.
America has a deep and dark history of people using the power of the prosecutor as an instrument of injustice. I knew this history well, of innocent men framed, of prosecutors hiding information that would exonerate defendants.
Yes. And during her time as California's top cop, Harris contributed to that history repeatedly by going to bat on behalf of dirty prosecutors. Her office appealed the dismissal of a case in which a prosecutor had fabricated a confession to secure a conviction and fought an appeal in a case where a prosecutor had lied to the jury during trial. In 2015, Harris tried to stop the removal of the Orange County District Attorney's Office from a murder trial after it repeatedly failed to turn over evidence to the defense. Her office even tried to keep a man in jail who had been wrongfully incarcerated for 13 years after a judge ruled that he had proven himself innocent just because the man hadn't delivered that proof quite fast enough. And as San Francisco DA, Harris hid known misconduct by a crime lab technician who admitted to deliberately tainting evidence.
Did prosecutors working under you know about the concerns about that lab?
The prosecutors,
which is what the judge alleged,
did not know about it, at least said they did not know about it.
The debacle has since led to the dismissal of hundreds of criminal cases.
Something else it's past time we get done is dismantling the failed war on drugs, starting with legalizing marijuana.
Your opponent, okay. Ron Gold, has said that he is for the legalization of marijuana recreationally. Your thoughts on that?
That he is entitled to his opinion.
Harris is a former drug warrior who is now refashioning herself as pro-legalization. That's a positive shift, but not a reason to rewrite the past or ignore the patterns it reveals in her judgment. 4 years after the cultural tide had turned in favor of criminal justice reforms, Harris continued to support lock-em-up policies that disproportionately hurt minorities. As California Attorney General, Harris opposed marijuana legalization as late as 2014, promoted civil asset forfeiture without a conviction as a way to fight drug rings, and sought to more aggressively police prescription drug use. In her 2019 book, The Truths We Hold, An American Journey, Harris reveals that her drug warrior mentality hasn't changed.
We also need to reinstate the DEA's authority to go after the major pharmaceutical manufacturers and distributors, and we need to invest resources in law enforcement efforts to cut off the supply of fentanyl from China.
Let's believe in a more perfect union without mass incarceration of African American men.
We put more people in prison than any country on earth for no good reason.
Yes, we do. And once these people were in prison, Harris saw to it that they'd have a hell of a time getting out.
I absolutely believe there should be severe and serious consequence for violent crime, which is why I've prosecuted those cases and will always seek the highest sentence.
As a prosecutor in law enforcement, I have a huge stick. So I decided I was going to start prosecuting parents for truancy.
Before her recent about-face, Harris chose not to endorse proposed sentencing reforms on the California ballot in 2012 and 2014, and she defended the constitutionality of cash bail until 2016. Harris's office also fought an order to reduce California's prison population after the Supreme Court determined the conditions amounted to cruel and unusual punishment. Although she later claimed to be shocked by what they had done, Harris's attorneys argued that nonviolent offenders should stay behind bars because the state needed the cheap labor they provide.
We are part of a longer story, and we are responsible for how our chapter gets written.
As she tries to convince voters to put her a heartbeat away from the presidency, Kamala Harris is trying to rewrite her last chapter, but her record is yet another reminder of the terrible choice voters face in the 2020 election.
I think you can judge people by when they are under fire, and it's not about some fancy opinion on a stage, but when they're in the position to actually make a decision, what do they do?
Okay, so lots there. We'll continue talking about it.
Well, that last line is really a great tag because it's exactly what she's been doing, right? She's saying we shouldn't do this, and that's what she's obviously been doing.
We should not do what I've been doing for my career since 1990. it was mentioned in there that she went after parents who had truant kids. Here's the thing. As libertarians, we believe that mandatory schooling should be abolished. Plain and simple. If a kid doesn't want to go to school, they shouldn't be forced to go to school, because what that does is that lowers the performance of the other kids sitting in the school. And so a prosecutor who is prosecuting parents for their truant child, let's put our thinking caps on and think about what type of parent has a truant child. It's probably a single parent whose life is somewhat chaotic and they're barely hanging on because they're lower income parents. Typically, your middle class and upper class parents send their kids to school. Oftentimes, the parent who has a truant child isn't even aware that their kid is truant, that isn't showing up to school. It's a surprise to them. And so She's now making life harder on the very people that she says she supports. So, you know, when she's been confronted with this, she laughs. She laughs about it. And so she has this tendency that keeps getting her in trouble that you will see again through the campaign, is that when she's confronted with criticism or her record, she laughs it off. She like Trump keeps kind of pointing that laugh out and doesn't like her laugh. The right does too. Hillary Clinton did the same thing. It gets her in trouble because it comes across as very insensitive. It, you know, similar to the famous line from Hillary, you know, we came, we saw, we died. You know, that line that you've heard in every sound clip. So, you know, she chose to really crack down on these victimless crimes that ended up making life harder for the economically disadvantaged in her community, which is what she said she's against now. She was a major prosecutor of marijuana while using it herself. You know, she fought to keep people, if a judge tried to be lenient, she fought to keep people in prison even after her state adopted policies that let the over-incarcerated go free. She opposed those. She fought the state in trying to allow these victimless criminals out of jail. She also, in 2012, Superior Court Judge Ann Christine Masullo ruled that San Francisco District Attorney Harris's office violated the defendant's rights by hiding damaging information from police crime lab technicians, destroying evidence, and ignored demands from lawyers and judges in responding to what happened to missing evidence. In 2015, an appeals court summoned her for review of three of her many cases that result in an innocent person being convicted. In one, she allowed a fake confession to be used in court. In another, she committed perjury by telling a prosecutor to change his story based on evidence he would have known, he wouldn't have known. By repeating this false testimony in court, she perjured herself. In a third case, she gave evidence to a technician that was not obtained from the scene of the crime in order to make a fingerprint connection. Though guilty on all three counts, a federal judge nullified any penalty Harris would have received, but told Harris's lawyers to, quote, talk to the attorney general and make sure she understands the gravity of this situation. Her office also appealed the overturning of capital punishment. She was pro-death penalty. Civil asset forfeiture has been a tool that she has used aggressively. Taking people's things without a charge against them is downright piracy, basically. And it's an abuse of a law that is vastly different from intent. And Harris was a huge part of perpetuating that problem. When it was discovered that she defeated a bill that would have paid prisoners $1 per hour instead of 8 to 32 cents, she explained, "The way that argument played out in court does not reflect my priorities. The idea that we incarcerate people to have indentured servants is one of the worst possible perceptions. I feel very strongly about that. It evokes imagery of chain gangs, despite having advocated for not increasing the wage to a dollar." She advocated behind the scenes for one thing and then said to the public when challenged another. This is a pattern, and this was not that long ago. Her tactics made it so that these nonviolent prisoners could be janitors for 8 cents an hour, but forbid them from pursuing jobs like firefighting for $1 per hour, which would have given them skills that made their recidivism rate much lower while giving them some economic cushion once they left. While it's a common problem for Democrats to promise too much free stuff, Harris was actually the worst offender. She was actually measured, and John Stossel has a great video that we put in the show notes. Overall, is Elizabeth Nolan Brown, who wrote this great article called Kamala Harris is a Cop That Wants to Be Now Vice President. She writes, "In the public eye, she spoke of racial justice and liberal values, bolstering her cred as one of the Democratic Party's rising stars. But behind closed doors, she repeatedly fought for more aggressive prosecution, not just of violent criminals, but of people who committed misdemeanors and, quote, quality of life crimes." And has she changed? She has changed on marijuana. At least we can see that. And she now gives lip service to popular ideas. Nick Gillespie called her arguably one of the most libertarian on drug policy at this point, and wrote an article saying so and giving his argument why. But you know, there's just a very clear pattern when you look at her record over these 30 years of doing the least, like, where libertarians and progressives overlap, it is in terms of criminal justice. It is in terms of ending the drug war. It is in terms of not prosecuting nonviolent criminals. It is taking the boot of the state off the neck of people, especially those who can't afford to fight for themselves, who the public defender system is broken. It doesn't actually defend people from a prosecutor because they're overworked. They may have 70, 80, 90 cases that they're trying to work through, whereas a prosecutor has almost, they don't have endless resources, but they have a lot more resources than a public defender does. Or even you, if you were able to hire an attorney. This is a person that, when she was in power, as Tulsi Gabbard so eloquently pointed out, that destroyed her presidential run, when she had the opportunity to do something about these issues, she chose not to do anything. In fact, she chose to suck up to the public because she thought they wanted her to be tough on crime. She didn't take the principled stance. She didn't side with progressives or libertarians on these issues. She was part of the problem. She was a draconian prosecutor. When Killer Mike is standing in Atlanta during the riots 3 months ago saying, beat up your local prosecutor who chooses to over-criminalize, he's talking about Kamala Harris. Prosecutors have enormous leeway in what laws they choose to enforce and how aggressively they choose to enforce it. And this is a person that when they had power, they chose to aggressively pursue certain things for political gain. And do we want that person at the level, at a higher level of power, knowing that she is going to continue to abuse those who she says she's fighting for? I don't think so. I think it's disqualifying her record. Even if she says she's had a change of heart, her ethics are challenged at best and her word is suspect.
Well, and the problem is, too, that if you have a change of heart, that's all well and good. But if you, your history shows you saying one thing and doing another, then it becomes a you have to show me type of situation. You can't just say all the right things because you've said all the right things before, but your actions never backed it up. So I think that's the situation she's in now.
Yeah.
Where she's saying all the right things because politically she knows what she's supposed to say. But let's see some action. Let's see some actual proof that you really believe this or you have turned over another leaf. You know, when Nick talks about her being libertarian on drugs, it's, you know, the history shows that's not the case. Now, she may have had a change of heart and she's saying the right things, but what is she doing to back that up is the question, right?
Yeah. So can you trust her? Can you trust Joe Biden? I don't, in these two episodes, feel that you can trust them any more than you can trust Donald Trump. I mean, you know, it's if you're a principled person, you're going to have to compromise your principles to vote for one of the major two-party candidates. It's just that simple. The things that you believe have to be compromised in order to vote for Donald Trump or for Joe Biden or for their running mates. It just is what it is. If you are a Tea Party Republican from Indiana, I beat up on them yesterday. I looked at my friend Mike Neal, who worked on his campaign, and I said, where's the bottom for you? You have told me for years you're a constitutional Christian conservative who believes in these things, and Mike Pence did too, but look at this man. You're debasing yourself. Well, I can vote for somebody without compromising my morals. Yeah, but you lessen your credibility with those not in your crowd, and your crowd is ever shrinking. If you believe in the Black Lives Matter movement, if you believe in ending the drug war, ending mandatory minimums, ending qualified immunity, ending, you know, the tools available to draconian prosecutors like Kamala Harris, can you trust Joe Biden? Because when you look at their records, you can't. You cannot trust the two of them. They have, when they were in power, made the wrong decisions every time. Now the pushback from liberals is, we can hold them more accountable if Joe Biden is in office. And I'd say, have the Republicans held Donald Trump accountable in office? Or do they do whatever a president wants because Congress has become a lackey to the president? Can you trust them? And the answer is you cannot trust any of the four of these people.
Well, the other thing, too, is they'll come back and say, well, that's just Trump and his cult with the Republicans. But they prove they don't do that when Obama was in office and he wanted to continue the wars and bomb people and do all the stuff that for years the left was railing against as anti-war. We need to stop these wars. We need to get out of Afghanistan. We get out of Iraq. He continued all of that stuff and they all turned a blind eye. They did not hold him accountable.
Yeah.
Like they said, they say they're going to do now. So how can you trust them when they've proven that they couldn't do that then?
It's the cult of the omnipotent state. I think it was Murray Rothbard that coined that. It's the idea that the federal government, the cult of the presidency, as Gene Healy wrote a great book on the cult of the presidency. The cult of the omnipotent state is the idea that the federal government, the state governments, that government at all can save you, that it helps you, it benefits you. In reality, they tell you one thing and they do the other. And so until, like, what I always try to tell people is you know the truth. You feel it in your head, in your heart. You know it in your head. You just need it to reach your balls. And so you need to start voting differently or doing what TK Coleman talked about in that great episode with him, innovating our way out of this and stop looking to the state altogether to save you in any way, shape, or form. Build a life around libertarian principles and peaceful solutions and economic opportunity for new people and grow the power of libertarianism and our ideals to the point that people look at that example and go, I'm done with this cult of thinking that these people are in my corner. I want to try something differently. All right. Well, I guess we're done then.
No, I was just, sorry. I was on mute there. I also just kind of read a comment too about, so we're talking about not being able to trust Trump or not being able to trust, you know, Biden or Kamala or Mike Pence. And someone mentions that, well, Joe Jorgensen's not going to get a lot of energy, you know, not going to win. She's lucky to get 1%. So what? I mean, do you think you should vote just because you think that your guy is going to win if you vote for him? Like if you vote for Trump and Trump loses, did you waste your vote? Did you throw your vote away? Did it not mean anything at that point? No, you should vote for the person who you want to win because that's the only way that you can actually send a message. So we have polling, but nobody believes polling anymore. We have, when you call your representatives, well, they're only getting a small percentage of people calling them, so they have a larger weight behind them. So how do politicians really know how the voters feel except by the voting? And if you start seeing more and more people voting for third parties or for other candidates than them, they're going to start wondering why, and they're going to pivot. They're going to change. That's how we got a lot of the drug legalization that's going on right now, is because people like libertarians would be there saying, this is important to us. And if you don't vote, or if you don't give us what we're looking for on these areas, we're going to vote for your opponent. Well, they're going to change and try and incorporate that into their message, into what they're planning to do. They'll pivot that and it'll become their idea. It'll become the Democrats achieve this or the Republicans achieve that. But if those are things you care about, you don't really care at that point. You just want those implemented the right way. And the way to do that is to send that message. And the only way to send the message is to vote for the people who are talking about those things and who are making those things be important.
Right? Yeah. Like, I'm not going to lie to you. I've only seen lower ballot races win in the in these local races. Libertarian Party people do win. There's several elected officials here in Indiana at the Libertarian level. But your vote is registered. It shows that you're a protest vote. It shows that you're rejecting the immorality and the principles of the two-party system. It shows it isn't you're opting out of the self-protect, you know, the idea that Republicans will fight Democrats and Democrats will fight the other. Like, you're actually voting for somebody that reflects your values, and it's registered. And the more people that make that choice, the more that's going to grow. And the more it grows, people will start to look and go, oh, they have a shot. They have a chance. Libertarianism has grown exponentially over the last decade since I've been around. Like, when I started calling myself a libertarian in the 2000s, I had to explain what that was. I still kind of have to explain what it is, which is what LibertyExplained.com is about. But it's a common topic of conversation now. Libertarian ideas are more accepted by the mainstream. We need to reach out to those, to that third of the country that doesn't vote, because they don't see their voice represented. That's why we do this show, is to talk to the people that don't feel that they're represented by their government. So secondly, it's a matter of free speech, and fighting for ballot access laws and changes and ending gerrymandering. And, you know, people like Matt Gaetz and Ro Khanna, who are on opposite sides of so much in Congress, both agree on things like term limits and drawing districts that are not gerrymandered, that are drawn by AI. Libertarians agree with that, too. There is a critical mass on some of these major issues. So neither of these two candidates have earned your vote. You know, now Joe Jorgensen has to earn your vote, too. I totally understand if you look at this and go, I'm opting out. I heard Jason Stapleton say on his show the other day, I'm opting out of this totally. I'm not even going to worry about politics, because it just doesn't, I don't want it to affect my emotions anymore. It doesn't affect my life anymore. I'm opting out. I'm going to build something better. I'm going to build a better mousetrap. And Jason is great at explaining and helping people do that. And I love politics too much to kind of focus on that. And that's why I do this kind of show. I'm not going to lie to you that the Libertarian Party is dysfunctional like the other two parties. The Libertarian Party is an organization of broken human beings like every other party or organization. The Libertarian Party has no power. You will not win a lot of elections. It will suck the first time you run for office and get 3%, and you may never recover from it. It's hard. But at least when you look in the mirror, you don't feel disgusted with yourself voting for a complete hypocrite. Let's hear what Jorgensen herself has to say. The first part is from the 96 vice presidential run that she had, and the second is from this run here.
Your question was, why vote for a third-party candidate? My answer is because the only party offering what you want is a third party, the Libertarian Party.
I think the only wasted vote is one for Trump or Biden, because they're going to give us more of what we don't want. If you want higher taxes, if you want more bungling in government, if you want to keep the troops all over the world, if you want more pollution, if you want more expensive health care, then by all means, vote for Trump and Biden. I would say if you want something different, vote for something different, which would be the Libertarian Party. And I'd also like to point out that we can also make change even without being elected.
Reinhold, give me your final thoughts on Kamala Harris.
Kamala Harris is a very ambitious politician, and did what she needed to do to get herself a name and a following, and put herself in a position where she could be considered as a presidential candidate or a vice presidential candidate. I think that her ideas and views on law enforcement are horrendous. I would hate to see her as president. And I would hate to see the other three people as president as well. So it's hard to say where that lies on the ranking of which ones would be worse, right? I think it was kind of a bad pick giving the movement that's been going on over the summer with BLM and everything. I think it was just putting a retardation on that movement. It's slowing that movement down that was kind of actually starting to maybe accomplish something. And I know that there's a lot of people who are trying to stop that movement now, and this isn't going to help. And we're going to end up going back to the way things were, and nobody's going to get anything's not, nothing's going to get fixed. And it's really frustrating to see that happen. I think a different pick may have countered that and gave us a better result. But at the end of the day, she's the one who's most likely going to be the president. If Biden wins, she'll, I think, be taking on a lot more role as that kind of changes. I don't think Biden will be able to do the full job, so he's going to have to delegate a lot of it to her so she can be ready for 2024. So I think we're going to see that. And in this race, more than any other, I think both of the vice presidential candidates have to be considered more than we've seen in the past.
Yeah.
Because I think both of them are going to be very influential on what happens if they get elected.
I disagree that she has any impact on the race. I think polling has kind of bared that out this past week. I think it, you know, when they broke it out by segments of voter, no Democrat can win the presidency without the black female vote. And she didn't hurt him or help him. It sort of was neutral in that particular category. By and large, everybody shrugged, and that's because she was the safe choice. Like, in our echo chambers, we're outraged that he would put an authoritarian person. I really genuinely believe that this is an authoritarian minded person in the way that Trump is. I don't think that Biden thinks in terms of like, I want total and complete power, but I definitely think that about Kamala Harris, Donald Trump, and Hillary Clinton. You know, and so it raises an alarm in us that we go, this is too much. But I think in terms of voter turnout, in terms of independence, I don't think it necessarily hurts. So, all right. Thank you, everyone, for joining us here on this episode of We Are Libertarians. We appreciate you so much, and we will talk to you again next Saturday.